Hey everyone, I'm Simmer, a student at Harvard University.
And I'm Roger, a student at King's College London.
And this is That Medic Podcast.
In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking to Sam Shah, the founder and director of the Faculty of Future Health at Ulster University. Sam has held several digital health positions across the NHS and has been named the fourth most influential BAME tech leader by the Financial Times. In today's show, we discuss the digital divide within healthcare, the implementation of NHS 111, and what it means to be a leader from the BAME community. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you guys do too. So, without further ado, let's have a listen. Sam, welcome to That Medic Podcast. You know, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, look, great to join you, Roger, and really pleased to hear what you're doing, and especially the way in which getting information to lots of medical students, I'm sure, will help them make lots of choices in the future.
Brilliant. So Sam, I thought I'd sort of, jump straight in and ask the question, why do you think technology within healthcare is so important?
So technology, like anything else, has evolved. And it's unlikely in the future that we'll be able to do our jobs in healthcare, in medicine, in surgery, even in public health, without using technology. Now, technology isn't a new thing. We've always had technology, whether it's been medicine's technology, so the creation of antibiotics, technology to help us with things like transplants, or even technology that might help us do our jobs, like record systems. So technology is certainly not new, but it's evolving, and it's evolving quickly. And with that in mind, it's unlikely in the future that any of us will practice without some component of technology as part of our work. And more importantly, it's unlikely that our patients will interact with us without also using technology.
So when it comes to actually implementing, this digital transformation across the NHS, what are the main challenges which tend to arise?
I think the problems in the NHS and the problems globally aren't that dissimilar. Like anything, we've got history. Legacy. So for a long time, we might have all used certain products, services, even technology. We might work in a certain way, and we're used to doing that. We're taught to work in a certain way. We might all go to the same organizations, and we all happen to have similar beliefs. But technology can disrupt all of that. But that tension of disrupting the status quo versus doing what we're already doing is very difficult to navigate. And so the tensions in any transformation program in the world are fairly similar, whether that's in health or in other sectors. There's three components that we have to first of all try and get right. The first thing we have to do is have some sort of strategy in place around where we want to get to. We've got to design and organize ourselves in a way in which makes sense. And then probably most importantly, we've got to get the right people to deliver that change. And that's everyone. That's clinicians, managers, and even trying to work with citizens and patients in that. That exists across any transformation program. But there are four challenges that come about in healthcare in particular, and let's say digital transformation. The first one is generally always culture. Culture has to change, the culture around what the technology might be, as well as the culture around making change happen. Then there's the entire issue of regulation. Healthcare is highly regulated, not just in the UK, but all over the world. We have to do that to maintain safety, to ensure that we maintain ethics and values, and also so that we can continue to provide safe services in lots of different ways. And then there's the way in which we procure and commission and buy services. That's always really complex. The financing, funding, resourcing of healthcare is hard. And that means we have to change that model, which doesn't always sit well with technology that sometimes spans boundaries of different things. And then finally, there's the issue of the underlying technology itself. Do we have the right sort of infrastructure? Do all those systems speak to each other, let's say, in the right language? Are they able to be connected to achieve the outcomes for technology or not? That in itself is a challenge, and a challenge everywhere. So those, the combination of the way in which we're organized and the people that we have, alongside some of the systemic issues that we might have, often result in barriers to transformation.
So I suppose, one of the biggest barriers is health inequality, which has sort of led to this digital divide we see, across the UK and abroad. I was reading an article recently by Cambridge, And they were saying how, you know, 22% of the UK's population lack, you know, basic digital skills. So, you know, if we were to sort of go forward and digitize the NHS and healthcare generally, you know, this is probably going to sort of only increase the inequality gap we see. So, you know, what sort of things can we be doing to really address these issues?
Well, the digital divide is something that spans different areas, not just healthcare, but of course, covers a whole range of things. Every year, there are different surveys around the digital divide and what it means for different groups. But let's take a step up first of all. What is that digital divide? Well, it's everything from the availability of things like the internet, the availability of hardware, and also the skills that individuals might have. And what we shouldn't do is confuse the skills that you or I might need to go and go online and buy something from a shop, or to go and check our bank account, or to book a holiday, and confuse that with the skills needed to access healthcare. On top of that, we definitely shouldn't confuse those skills with those that might be needed by clinicians working in a healthcare environment to utilize technology. They're all different sets of skills. So when we think about the digital divide, we need to think about the context. What is it that we want people to do or not do digitally for which there's ended up being a divide? Now, at system level, you can certainly see that across England. You can see that digital penetration in different parts of the UK and in England and the other devolved nations is very variable. For example, London has relatively high digital penetration. 94% have access to the internet, to devices, might have the skills, all of those things. Go to somewhere like the West Midlands, Birmingham, it's considerably lower. And different parts of the UK have different levels of digital penetration. Globally, we can see this too. The United Arab Emirates is the most digitally penetrated place in the world, with 99% digital penetration. Nothing else beats it. The US, surprisingly, is lower. And then you go to other places like India and China, where it's considerably lower. But at the same time, this friction, this gap, this need generates and results in innovation. So take places like India and China, recognizing that there is some lack of digital penetration, you can already start to see that they've overcome this problem because they've thought about the needs of their citizens, and naturally, people are using the voice channel. So something I wouldn't have done a long time ago is left a voice note, and we probably wouldn't have been having a podcast discussion. But already in places like India and China, you're beginning to see that other technology is being used, the voice channel. In the UK, the US, and other places, it's less used. So I guess that digital divide means lots of different things. At the most basic level, it's probably about the availability of access to things like the internet and devices to get to the internet. It's probably a dividing point, and the skills that go with that. And that's where we need to think about inequalities, because the likelihood is those people that have the greatest need for healthcare, those people that might be from deprived backgrounds, that might have impairments, that might have disabilities, that might have difficulties with speech, with hearing, those people that might come from low-income families, are least likely to have either the skills, the accessibility, or even perhaps the understanding of how to use the internet. It might be as basic as not even having disposable income to pay for internet access. Now, to you or I, that might seem strange, but there's a whole group of people in society where that's a reality. So the more that healthcare becomes digitized, we have to be really mindful of that divide. Because for some people, healthcare becomes suddenly more accessible. They no longer have to take a day off work. They can access their GP from their desk. For other people, suddenly, it might become less accessible because they don't have access to those things that would give them the availability of their GP suddenly or urgent care. So we do have to watch out for the digital divide. And in the same way, in public health, we understand it needs assessments of what people need in society. I think we have to be mindful of the accessibility and availability of digital tools, skills in an area. And we have to watch out for our workforce too, because in time, we'll find parts of the workforce that may not have the skills to do the job they have to do right now.
Yeah, so on that point on the accessibility of healthcare, you know, would you say technology is really the answer? Or can we sort of increase accessibility by focusing on the social determinants of health?
Absolutely. And of course, healthcare is just one part of what happens in the dynamics of health outcomes, health inequalities, and inequity in access to healthcare. So if we look at the wider social determinants, it's made up of so many different components. Crime, education, housing, sanitation, all of these are components. And I would also say access to the internet is probably another component in there. So when thinking about tackling inequalities, we have to think far beyond healthcare. What can we do to help people with digital literacy more broadly so they're more likely to access employment? What do we do about education? Perhaps make it less rigid and more accessible to a broader range of people. Think about things like apprenticeships that might help with social mobility. And also reducing discrimination in society. Because by doing that and having a more inclusive workforce, we will lift people out of poverty. So these are more important things we have to think about beyond healthcare. Because a tiny proportion of health and healthcare and health outcome is directly related to health. Most of it is determined by those wider social determinants, the causes of the causes, that go far beyond health and healthcare. And so if we start tackling those things, we're more likely to have better health outcomes. And certainly something like the internet and digital skills will help people along that way. And there's good examples of certain banks and other industry players that are helping their customers and others skill up so they can more actively engage in what is going to become an increasingly more digital world.
So would you say there are any countries which have been able to sort of address these issues so far?
Well, I don't think there's any one country in the world that has completely cracked this. Everyone's got bits of it, and everyone's got parts of this, that nobody's completely dealt with it. And you could argue that perhaps if we took all the best learning from everywhere in different parts of the world, we might come much closer to achieving this. And you can certainly see that some regimes around the world have really high internet accessibility, but then they've got much smaller populations, they've got a lot more disposable income, and they have a very different ethical and legal regime to the one that we enjoy in the UK. But there are good examples of systems. There's some parts of Australia where they've linked lots and lots of data sets together between health and other parts of their system, where they can identify those things that individuals need across public services to help then prevent them ending up with ill health. Certainly in the UK and in England, there are schemes that have started up to try and bring these data sets together to drive better insights and make better decisions. But this process is not new. It's a dimension of public health. And I would say the underfunding of public health, the lack of resources, has meant that those things haven't really happened in the way they should have done. But that's hopefully beginning to change with the creation of integrated care systems at the moment in England, within the NHS, the potential movement of social care, and hopefully the focus again on informatics together might allow us to take a population health approach and start planning in a better way for commissioning and other reasons. So I certainly don't think any country around the world has got it perfectly right, and everyone's got small parts of best practice. Well, I would say to people who are listening, think broad and thinking about career opportunities, because inequalities in healthcare and public health in its own right allows and offers a whole career pathway to individuals ranging from epidemiology to working in industry. And those skill sets will be needed even more in the future.
So, you know, for students that are listening who, you know, are really interested in possibly exploring those opportunities, you know, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, first of all, recognize that digital health and technology is really broad. It covers everything from infrastructure, so computers and networks and data and all of those things, all the way through to apps and wearables. And different things will resonate with different people. For some people, they might want to have a light touch view and a bit of involvement in this area. For others, they might want to get deep into coding and developing. And so what I would say to all those listeners, from wherever they happen to be around the world, is just get involved in the conversation. Get involved online, through social media, in different networks. In most countries around the world, especially in the US and the UK, there are lots of networks. There are lots of commentators around the world. Connect with people, have discussions with people involved in technology, especially digital health, with new and emerging companies. See if you can get a placement, see if you can get a day or a few hours to go and shadow and see somebody. But keep the conversation going and get a feeling of what you might enjoy or like. And for a few people, that might involve undertaking a placement. For others, it might be a course. For some, it might just be reading about the topic. there's some great books out there that people can read, especially books by a gentleman called Robert Wachter. He was involved in the Wachter Review in England, which resulted in the plan that has created the fellowships that many people do in the NHS for digital health. There are lots and lots of papers and books by a gentleman called Professor Eric Topol. People like them have written great things about healthcare, digital health, technology, and the meaning for the workforce itself. You've got the paper that's been written by Atul Gawande and also his books, which are really interesting. And there's some great people to also follow in this area, both in the UK and elsewhere, who are commenting on this all the time. So I would say read around the topic, speak to lots of people, listen to this podcast, and listen to others, and participate in webinars where you can. But that will really give you an understanding of the sector.
Well, Sam, you know, that's some brilliant advice. So what I'll do is I'll put some links in the episode description below. Now, also understand that you're actually a director of digital development for NHS England, where you were sort of involved in the implementation of NHS 111, which, of course, has been a brilliant service, especially more recently during COVID-19. So just wondering if you could sort of explain to listeners, you know, how it went from that sort of initial idea to eventually being commissioned, you know, across the NHS.
Yeah. So I was the Director of Digital Development for NHS England, NHS Improvement, NHSX. And basically my role involved heading up some national programs and watching the implementation and supporting the implementation into the system. And what that really means is things like 111 online. My team were very much developing that solution, testing it and deploying it. And of course, during COVID, that was used as one of the main routes through which people identified their symptoms and connected to health services. My team was also responsible for other things like the National Directory of Service that is used to list all the services in England that different systems connect to. And they also had other responsibilities. And one of the things my team used to do was connect with those people in the digital health community, innovators, technology providers, academics, lots of others, to understand the direction of digital health and try and shape and influence and develop strategies to starting to bring some of those ideas into the health service. So we did lots of different things. One of the areas, as you mentioned, was 111 Online. And to give you the history of it, I've been involved in it for almost 10 years. And it started off as a telephone number, which people phoned. And of course, it still is. 111 is a phone number. It's the non-emergency urgent care number for England. And people phone that number. They speak to a health advisor who assesses their symptoms using a pathways tool that was being created by NHS Digital that I used to oversee. And then after that, they just get referred to a service and sometimes booked in. Now, what we recognised is people were going online, and my predecessor very much championed this, a lady called Deborah El-Sayed, who is absolutely fantastic, that we need to go online with the service. So we, for a few years, worked together on developing different ways of doing this and worked with a great team of people who are still in the system in different places, but they basically worked out and tested different ways of approaching this problem. And initially, we started off by using third-party services. We worked with lots of companies. We worked with a company called Sensely in the West Midlands. We worked with another company, DoctorLink, Expert 24, in another part of the country, with Babylon, and NHS Digital itself. And we tested and tried all these different ways of doing things. And what you soon realize, in a health service like the NHS in England, where you've got more than 30,000 different organizations who are all independent, with almost 1.4 million patient interactions every 24 hours, and a workforce of more than 1.3 million people, this is complex, and you can't possibly please everyone. So you have to make some decisions. So we had to make a decision, which was we go with one of those, and in the end, when we balanced everything, like cost and risk and governance, which are all important things in such critical service, as well as what we could realistically deploy in a certain period of time. We balanced all of those things. The decision was then made to go with the national product, the NHS Zone product, NHS Pathways, creating 111 Online. And the team built that. And we had to then connect with every single provider in the country delivering urgent care, 111, 999, to make sure that we could deploy this service. And that takes time, that takes teams. And we had lots of different teams, a clinical team, a development team, a technical team, a deployment team, lots and lots of different teams working together around the country. And I suppose what made that work was collaboration, communication and collaboration, constantly communicating using tools, which are like Slack, for example. And Slack was one of the things that was brought in as part of this deployment that we used to connect to all of the different providers around the country.
Now, I understand that you were both, you know, Director of Digital Transformation for NHS England, but also for NHSX. But I'm just wondering if you could sort of clarify, you know, exactly what NHSX is and why it was sort of founded in the first place.
So NHSX is an internal department within NHS England at the moment. So like you have departments like HR and finance, another department is NHSX. It's a hybrid between the Department of Health and Social Care and NHS England. It has some staff from the Department of Health and some from NHS England. And ultimately, it's there to do a few things. But one of the things it does, it supports the strategy of the NHS and fulfilling the Secretary of State's technology vision. So that's Matt Hancock's technology vision. It also is responsible for things like what we call spend control. So that's something that the system has to do to make sure that when technology spend happens in the NHS, that a part of the system sort of checks that. And it's also responsible for commissioning the delivery of some national programs. That fundamentally are the main things that it does. It does lots of other things as well, of course, stakeholder engagement, a bit of horizon scanning, but mainly it does those things. And it has a team of people that work together to deliver some programs. So, for example, there are a team there that are working with entrepreneurs and innovators to see what new ideas are coming about and how they can help facilitate access to the NHS. They work with NHS Digital very closely on the deployment of national programs. So things like the NHS email system or the network that supports the whole of the NHS, or even cybersecurity across the NHS. And they work with other parts of the system to help them with their strategy in influencing what the next direction of travel is. So, for example, with primary care colleagues in NHS England to develop the strategy for online consultation, so the way in which people connect to their GPs. So there's lots of different things that they do, as well as working with industry. So they're the sort of main things that NHSX gets involved with.
So, Sam, you know, clearly you have lots of experience in digital health transformation. And all your experiences have led to your sort of nomination as a leader in tech from the BAME community. So my real question is, you know, what does it mean to be a BAME tech leader?
Yeah, so lots of people will know that this is a topic area that's become very, very topical across the world, and rightly so. We do have to do much more to ensure that people from Black, Asian, and other minority ethnic communities are certainly participants included and represented all parts of public sector life. And in healthcare, it's never really been very balanced. And in technology, it's sometimes become inaccessible to some people. And so part of this and part of the nomination is for championing the cause, creating a team that is truly diverse, representing all types of diversity, including the representation of the BAME community. And for me, it's about culture. It's about bringing about a culture, a safe space where people have psychological safety, where they can prosper, where they can feel enthused about their work, they can develop, and at the same time, they can grow and move on to the next role. And so for me, the role of the nomination, certainly from the FT and others, was very much around championing the cause and agitating the system and highlighting the issues and the problems that come about with structural racism. And unfortunately, in public sector at the moment, and I do hope it changes, there is a lot of structural racism. And so one thing that we need to do is not only educate and raise awareness of what some of the problems are, but we also need to bring about that change. And that involves creating the next set of leaders across the spectrum who can help others and send the ladder down to bring others up through the system and change their life course. But at the moment, the entirety of public sector is certainly not in the place we'd want it to be. And having worked in an organisation like the centre of the NHS, it is very clear that it's very difficult for anyone from a Black background and other groups as well, but particularly for Black people, they suffer from this, from aggressions and from racism and from the ceilings in the system. And this has to change. And certainly for me, being an advocate for this means advocating for that change and calling things out when they're not right. And this is hard because I am certainly not underprivileged. I am not actually in the category of people who is worst affected by this, because there will be people from single parent families, from very deprived backgrounds, from different levels of education, and those people that due to the color of their skin and where they were, where they come from by ancestry, will be discriminated against far more than I will. And we need to change this. So ultimately, the nomination was great. But what now matters is continuing to speak out and talk about it and talk to other leaders in the system that I have access to try and bring about a change and a movement, so in the future, we don't face the same degree of problem.
So what sort of things can students be doing to ensure there's greater representation, you know, of the BAME community?
Yeah, and there's lots of things one can do. You know, you can do everything from light touch involvement. You can obviously have discussions about it with one another, join different groups. And there are lots of groups that are evolving in this area. But the main thing is not just about seeing it, but also seeing it, talking about it, and doing something about it. And actually, when it's wrong, to not participate, but not just not to participate, to call it out. And that's really hard to do, and you have to be in a safe space to do it, and you can't do it all the time. But having those conversations is really important. And the thing that we have to all remember is that if we want the best outcomes for society, we have to be truly inclusive, because inclusivity in decision-making will result in better outcomes and better health outcomes. And if we want those better health outcomes, yeah, we have to change those things. We have to change culture and practice and people. And we get the broadest range of people, we'll get the best set of outcomes. But to do that takes a big change in the system as a whole, one that hasn't happened recently. So I would say keep talking about it. Not only talk about it, join groups where you can, participate in the conversation. Everyone out there has a valid view. So, you know, I think... You've got to think about what's happening in terms of the temper and the mood and catch on to that. But don't ever feel that you're alone out there, and connect with other people also interested in the topic area. And I'm always happy to talk about this at length.
Well, Sam, I think that's some, you know, brilliant actual advice there. And, you know, for students that are listening, I think it's really important that they sort of go off and have those important conversations to see what sort of things they can be doing to ensure there is, you know, greater representation, you know, whilst in medical school. Now, Sam, you know, we're nearly wrapping up, but before you go, you know, I understand that you sort of recently launched the Faculty of Future Health at Ulster University. So just wondering if you could talk a bit about, you know, why you set up the faculty in the first place, but also, you know, what you hope to achieve.
Well, the Faculty of Future Health is a new faculty, part of the Ulster University, working with the College of Medicine and Dentistry. And the whole reason it came about was that I was being asked by lots of different people about courses and ways in which they can improve their education, knowledge and skills around public health, clinical leadership and digital health. So the faculty has been created to create applied learning programs where people can join them at an MSc level, at a diploma level, certificate or even a bachelor's level, and improve their not only their skills and knowledge, but also get some practical application by industry placements and other ways. And that was the main thing. And the purpose of this is to create a flexible mode of learning that makes these things more accessible so that the broadest range of people can hopefully get skilled up and make a difference later on. And there's loads of great courses out there from lots of different universities and organizations. Many of my colleagues are running some of those things. But the more traditional universities tend to offer very linear programs, or some where they're almost entirely online. So the blend here is to try and provide a bit of both, but combine that with industry placements that will give people experiences that will help them progress in their careers.
It sounds like a really brilliant program. I think, you know, having that sort of practical aspect where you're able to sort of apply the skills you've been developing over time, I think it makes it for a much more, you know, sort of a rewarding experience. Now, Sam, before you go, I'm just wondering whether you had, you know, three pieces of advice that you could give to students interested in digital health.
The most important thing I would say is keep talking to people. Talk to each other about ideas, about things you read. Remember, digital health is so new that a lot of it won't be in a scientific paper. It won't be in a journal, but the material will be out there in soft forms. So keep reading about things. Subscribe to things from HIMSS or from Mobi Health or from digital health networks. Those are really good sources of information. The HSJ has some digital content too. But these are places where you'll learn about what's happening in the sector. go and meet with people who are in digital health organizations. Don't be afraid. Everyone's got to start somewhere. Try and go to some of the events that are taking place. So these are really important things. But the other thing is to also be truly innovative and entrepreneurial. Horizon scan for those things in other sectors that you might be able to translate into healthcare that no one else has thought of. Because I am sure there are medical students that will be listening that will create the next unicorn. They will be the ones that will figure something out that people like me who are too jaded will not be able to see, and they will be able to create that next thing. So, and so don't think that any idea is a bad idea. Explore it. Have a conversation. That process of learning itself is important. And the great thing about digital health is it has no boundaries. Even though you might be future clinicians, talk to other people who are not clinicians. Talk to people that you have access to right now at university, because as time goes on, you won't. So talk to the data scientists, talk to the computer science students, talk to some of those people studying biotechnology, all of those other people that you interact with right now that one day when you're in a hospital or when you're in a practice, you won't have access to them. So make lots of friends outside of your sector, lawyers that might later on be involved in IP or med tech. There are so many people you have access to at university. Make full use of them. Make lots of friends outside, and later on, you might collaborate again. So the important things are listen to lots of stuff going on and read anything you feel like doing, but read a little bit. Talk to people and connect with agencies and companies where you might want to get some experience. And finally, be inclusive. Speak to lots of friends in other areas outside of medicine.
Sam, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it, and really look forward to listening to your other podcasts too.
Hey guys, thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you all enjoyed it. If you did, I'd really appreciate if you'd give us a rating and drop a comment on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter with all the links in the description below. And of course, feel free to reach out to us on thatmedicpodcast@gmail.com.